It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll find out why more than 500,000 people are still logging into the online world of Second Life almost 15 years after the virtual game-like service was launched. First, Attorney General Jeff Sessions announced that he will bring two new federal prosecutors to Milwaukee. In a speech yesterday at the federal courthouse in Milwaukee, Sessions talked about high homicide rates and emphasized his message on law and order.
I'm afraid we're seeing we've abandoned some of our successful principles. I think the crime rate is going up, and we need to get serious again about what we can do about it. And the president's order to us was to reduce crime in America, his third order. And I told him Friday, we embrace that challenge.
Michael O'Hara is a professor at Marquette University Law School. He's the author of the forthcoming book, Wisconsin Sentencing in the Tough on Crime Era. He's here to take a closer look at the potential impact of Sessions' decision. Michael, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Very glad to be here.
What's the significance, Michael, of appointing two more federal prosecutors to focus on violent crime in the Milwaukee area?
Well, it's showing that the federal government under President Trump and Attorney General Sessions, the federal government is trying to bring federal resources to bear to help cities deal with rising crime rates. And Milwaukee is one of the cities in the United States that has been experiencing a spike in homicides in recent years. Our story hasn't been quite so prominent as Chicago's, but in some ways is reminiscent of what's been happening in Chicago. And President Trump has earlier indicated that he would like to provide more federal support for fighting homicides in Chicago. And what Attorney General Sessions announced yesterday for Milwaukee seems to be in the same spirit.
What, on a practical level, would two more federal prosecutors do when it comes to law enforcement and prosecution?
Well, I think we have to say right up front that two prosecutors will not make a huge difference. There might be some benefits around the margins, but certainly an addition of just two prosecutors in a city that has dozens of state and federal prosecutors, an addition of two in and of itself is not exactly a game changer, but most likely what I would expect these new prosecutors to do is to go after gun cases, particularly to get some federal prosecutions of people who have been convicted of violent crimes in the past who are found in possession of a firearm. It is, of course, illegal for a felon to possess a firearm, and there are some very stiff penalties available under federal law for felons who are found in possession of a firearm. All of these individuals could be prosecuted in state court, but the idea here is that if they're prosecuted by federal prosecutors in federal court, there will be likely significantly longer sentences imposed.
Is the hope here then that this deters that felon from getting the gun in the first place, or that takes these longer federal sentences take that felon who does have a firearm off the streets for a longer period of time?
Both. That's called deterrence and incapacitation. And the theory here is that you get a double benefit when you use these long federal prison terms for convicted felons who are found in possession of a firearm. You get a dangerous person off the street for a number of years, and you deter potentially dangerous people from acquiring guns in the first place.
Have we seen similar efforts in other cities around the country in recent history, adding more federal prosecutors? What's out there? What's the result been?
Well, what this current initiative reminds me of is some similar initiatives that were undertaken in the 1990s by the Clinton administration. The Clinton Department of Justice was also very interested in bringing federal resources to bear to try to combat violent crime in the nation's cities. And the two most prominent examples in the 90s were in Boston and in Richmond, Virginia. And in both cities, there was a big push to get these federal prosecutions and long federal prison terms for felons found in possession of a firearm. Both the Boston and the Richmond initiatives got a lot of national attention at the time and were generally regarded as successful initiatives. Both cities did experience some significant declines in violent crime while those initiatives were taking place.
Michael O'Hara is with us from the Marquette University Law School, looking at an announcement from Attorney General Jeff Sessions that two new federal prosecutors would be appointed to deal with violent crime in the Milwaukee area. Michael, this is in response, as you mentioned earlier, to rising crime rates, violent crime rates. Can you talk about what's happened to those rates over the last few years?
Yeah, sure. In Milwaukee, there has been a significant spike in violent crime. We've seen the homicide rate basically double since 2008. This is, again, similar to what you see in a number of other cities around the country. Chicago's had a huge spike, St. Louis, Baltimore. It may be similar, or there may be similar kinds of dynamics taking place in Milwaukee. It is interesting, though. I mean, some of the rhetoric we get from politicians suggests that the nation as a whole is engulfed in a massive crime wave, and that's simply not true. National crime rates are relatively low right now compared to where they have been otherwise in recent decades, and some cities like New York City just continue to experience year after year of continued decline in crime. But Milwaukee and a handful of other cities have had some pretty significant spikes in recent years. Milwaukee has developed one of the highest homicide rates in the country, although it's still significantly lower than what we find in the worst homicide cities like St. Louis and Baltimore and Detroit.
Now, there's an ongoing debate over how we handle crime and punishment in the U.S. calls for less focus on prosecution and incarceration, more on community interventions, things that try to prevent violence in the first place. Are those two necessarily at odds?
They don't have to be at odds necessarily, and probably there is some benefit to doing both things in a complementary sort of way. You are absolutely right that nationally, politicians on both sides of the aisles in recent years have been getting more and more interested in finding more cost-effective ways of dealing with crime than just doing arrests and prosecutions and long prison terms. And so there has been a lot of interest in prevention initiatives and rehabilitative programs, and we've been doing more and more of those as a nation. Those kinds of initiatives, again, are not inherently contradictory to a program that seeks to target the most dangerous repeat violent offenders and deter them from getting firearms in the first place, and in the second place, incapacitate them in prison for an extended period of time. These are not incompatible, except to the extent that our criminal justice system only has so many resources. And so at some point, there are concerns that, you know, for instance, if we are paying the amounts of money that we're paying to incarcerate people for long periods of time, we're just not going to have the resources available for instance, rehabilitative programming in the community.
And we'll leave it there, Michael. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sure, happy to do it.
That's Michael O'Hare from Marquette University Law School. He joined us for a look at Attorney General Jeff Sessions' decision to appoint two new federal prosecutors in Milwaukee. Coming up, we'll visit the virtual realm of Second Life and the people who still call it home. Stay with us here on Central Time. First, there was a time not so long ago that the future of the internet wasn't social media, things like Facebook or Twitter. It was supposed to be the virtual realm of Second Life, an online game-like service launched in 2003 that allowed users to create avatars and live a second life. But with the dominance of social media, Second Life have seemingly become a relic of the internet past. But it turns out that in 2017, more than 500,000 regular users still log in every month, and their reasons for doing so are diverse, complex, and in some cases, bittersweet. Leslie Jamison is an essayist and author who recently spent some time in Second Life. Her recent piece in The Atlantic is titled The Digital Ruins of a Forgotten Future. WPR producer Chris Molina recently talked to her about the people who keep returning to this virtual world long after most users have moved on.
So for those who are unfamiliar with Second Life, how would you describe what it is?
Second Life is an online platform where users can they can build things, they can build structures, they can build houses, they can build theme parks, they can build national parks, and people use it for a variety of reasons. They use it for social reasons, to make friends, to find romantic partners, to seek out online sex. They also use it for business purposes. You can sell objects and make money, and that money is convertible to real-world money. So a lot of people who use it really resist calling it a game, and I think that's because they think of it as a more holistic experience.
And you write that Second Life has become somewhat of a mockery, especially on the internet, and yet for some of the people who still engage with it, it's a real serious part of their lives. Can you share a story of one of the people that you talk to and how their real and virtual lives really differ from one another?
Yeah, so I was really interested in writing the piece, in part because I wanted to push back against some of the reductive stereotypes that I think we can have about people who spend a lot of time online in a particular way, like developing sort of alternate lives or existences. And a lot of the people I ended up speaking to really defied my preconceptions about somebody who would spend hours online. And one of those was a woman named Gidge, who that's her avatar online name, who is a mother of four in Atlanta. She works at a call center 8 hours a day. Two of her children have special needs, so her parenting life is very intense. But she actually wakes up at 5:30 in the morning, most mornings, to give herself time to spend an hour and a half on Second Life before she plunges into the rest of her day. And that really pushed back against my idea that, you know, people who have these very active online existences, it's always because they have kind of not a lot going on in their offline physical lives. But she was an example of somebody who actually has a lot going on, but gets something from her online life that she doesn't get offline.
And I think a lot of us may have this preconceived notion that, you know, with Second Life or anything else, we've got our real life and then we've got our virtual life. But for people who engage with Second Life and who may be doing things in the virtual world that they couldn't do in the real world, do those lines start to blur? And who's to say that a quote-unquote real thing is less authentic than a virtual experience?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, well, one thing to say is, you know, I could talk about people who spend a lot of time online and people who don't, but the truth is that so many of us spend a lot of time online, whether we're spending that time on email or on Facebook or on Twitter or on Instagram. Second Life is just kind of a more extreme articulation of that desire to live somewhat in this virtual sphere. And I think for most people, there's a really powerful connection between what it is that they're doing and saying and experiencing online and what happens offline. But certainly for a lot of the people I talk to, they think of their offline lives and their Second Lives as very integrated. So a woman named Alice, who has suffered from multiple sclerosis for many years and can physically do a lot of things, her avatar on Second Life can physically do a lot of things that she cannot do in the offline world. But she told me that she really resists, and I write about this in the piece, that she really resists the distinction between real life and Second Life, because to her Second Life is, and her experiences there, her relationships there, absolutely a part of her real life.
So when you set out to write this piece, it seems like you were hoping to have some kind of experience that these other people were experiencing, or sort of falling under Second Life's spell. But that didn't really happen for you. What do you think happened?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I think I acquired a lot of admiration for the kinds of worlds that people build and find on Second Life and the ways that it can work in people's lives. But I viscerally found the world of Second Life to be kind of disappointing and a little bit off-putting. And I think part of that is how, at one point I read in the piece that it sort of felt like living in a world of visual cliches, because if you go to a Mexican beach town, it looked like the kind of idea that somebody would have about a Mexican beach town, mm-hmm. rather than an actual place where, you know, sand and salt and wind and sun have, you know, weathered the buildings, and there are, you know, other human bodies going around. You feel the elements on your body, on your skin. I was just really aware of all the things that are lost when you kind of take out the grit and strangeness and contingency and unpredictability of the physical world, which is not to say Second Life is somehow deceiving anyone. It's not pretending to be an offline world. It's an online world. But I was sort of aware of what it was that I missed when I was there.
Well, as someone who is relatively free to do what you want and go where you want in the so-called real world, did you find that hampering your experience stepping into this virtual world?
I mean, I think it's an interesting point, and it's a moment of kind of self-awareness that I also articulate in this piece, where I say, you know, the truth is I am relatively healthy, I'm relatively young, I have a lot of things going for me in the real world or in the physical world, and that I never wanted to lose sight of the fact that there were certain kinds of privilege definitely underwriting my ability to even say something like I'm attached to the grit and imperfection of the world, and I miss it when I'm in this online space. So absolutely, I think that there are ways that some of the ways in which I've been lucky also might have obstructed a certain kind of intensity in my relationship to Second Life.
We're talking with Leslie Jamison, an essayist and author. Her recent piece in The Atlantic is The Digital Ruins of a Forgotten Future. And Leslie, it seems like Second Life never really caught on the way its creators thought it would. Well, at one point, the service hit 1 million users. Any momentum that it had was gone by sort of the mid to late 2000s, stamped out by social media. Why do you think Second Life didn't take off the way that Facebook and Twitter did?
Yeah, that's really one of the questions at the heart of the piece. And yeah, Second Life really peaked around 2007 or 2008, both in terms of hitting, as you mentioned, the million user mark, and it's, I think a lot of its creators expected it to keep rising from that million user mark, but instead it ended up declining and then kind of plateauing. But also in terms of, it got a lot of media attention. And especially in 2007, was thinking about, is this the future of the internet? Is this what our online existences are going to look like? And then we really went in a pretty different direction. And I think that some of that is that many people preferred to have online existences that were still controlled and curated, but bore more resemblance to their offline lives. So on Facebook, you can shape the persona you're crafting, but at the same time, you're crafting it from the materials of your actual physical life. And so, you know, it's what your kids did that day, what you're reading, what you're thinking, celebrating your friends' birthdays. And so I think that there's something about having a digital life that is connected in those overt ways to offline existence that it, for many people, is appealing. Mm-hmm. That said, in the tech world, there is certainly right now a ton of momentum and enthusiasm around the possibilities of virtual reality technology. So I think there's simultaneously still this idea or hope or kind of dream that fuller kind of immersion into online existence is still attractive and appealing to people. We just need to get the technology advanced enough to make it possible.
Yeah, and I'm glad that you brought that up, because I wanted to ask you about that. It does seem like we're sort of at this vanguard of a virtual reality revolution, potentially paving the way for a more immersive Second Life or whatever experience. And maybe it's one where instead of we're seeing our avatars in the third person on a computer screen, we're seeing it in first person through our own eyes, and everything is lifelike. Does that make it a more appealing and attractive experience for users?
Yeah, I mean, there are many people in the tech world who think absolutely yes. I imagine there are many people for whom that might hold a certain kind of draw and appeal. I think one of the things I was struck by in the course of talking to Second Life users was that people wanted to have very different kinds of relationships to their avatars. So some people wanted to feel this kind of total identification with the avatar as just an embodiment of them online. But for, I think for other people, the third person element of it was actually part of the appeal, that there was something alluring about having this self that they were controlling and inhabiting, but who was still apart from them in some way, a body they were watching rather than a kind of a perspective they were inhabiting completely.
So after spending the time that you did with Second Life and meeting the people for whom it still holds a very important place, what was your biggest takeaway in your personal life?
Well, a few things. One is that it's multiple and infinite, the variety of ways that people find to experience intimacy and meaning in the world, in the offline world and the online world, and that that I didn't feel like discounting at all the ways that sort of unexpected sources of intimacy or pleasure or relationship could be found in the world of Second Life. And that kind of opened me up to thinking about maybe there are lots of spaces where I might dismiss the possibility of what intimacy could look like here, but it actually could be, you know, really meaningful and engaging and rich. And another thing that I ended up thinking about was, you know, a lot of people call Second Life escapist or those kinds of online engagements. You know, it's like it's a form of escapism. But I really ended up thinking a lot about, not necessarily wanting to say, oh, nothing about Second Life is escapist, but more thinking about how escapism or a certain desire to escape your life temporarily is a part of everyone's existence, you know, and it takes so many forms. It takes the form of TV or daydreaming or art or drugs or your cell phone or whatever, but that there's nothing, it can certainly become destructive, but there's nothing intrinsically destructive about wanting to be outside your own life in some way or for a period of time. It's actually part of the definition of inhabiting a life, I think.
And that's a good place to leave it. Leslie, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure to talk.
That was essayist and author Leslie Jamison talking to WPR producer Chris Molina about the virtual world of Second Life. Her piece in The Atlantic is called The Digital Ruins of a Forgotten Future. Coming up, how social media keeps us too much in contact with the present. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. If you take a look at one of your social media feeds, you might be hard-pressed to find a post from more than a few hours or maybe even a few minutes ago. And that's no accident. Social media sites are designed to show us what's happening right now. But what happens when we're always focused on the present? Our guest says that could be a real problem and that by missing out on the bigger picture, we risk losing our ability to engage with some of the world's most complicated issues. Clive Thompson is a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine and Wired and the author of Smarter Than You Think, How Technology is Changing Our Minds for the Better. His recent piece for the magazine This is called Social Media is Keeping Us Stuck in the Moment. Clive, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, good to be here.
Well, and you write that social media platforms are designed around the idea of reverse chronology. That's kind of a key concept. Can you explain to us what that means?
Yeah, sure. I mean, if you were to open up, you know, Twitter right now, if you have a Twitter account or, you know, pretty much any social media like Instagram or your Facebook newsfeed, generally what they do is they show you the latest thing that someone said or did. And then you scroll down, it's something that happened a little before that and a little before that. And it goes backwards in time. Like, it's always refreshing you with the most recent thing, something that just happened right now. And then it goes backwards in time. But, you know, it's very hard to sort of scroll back and see what happened. Like, I mean, if I were to, you know, look at my Twitter feed, it's really easy to see, you know, wow, someone said this 10 minutes ago, 5 minutes ago, 3 minutes ago. But really hard to find what happened, like, you know, yesterday or a few weeks ago. So reverse chronology is when you start with what's happening right now and you go backwards in time.
And last time we talked to you, looking at your book, you're pretty positive on a lot of the changes that technology has brought us. This one, though, this being stuck in the moment, has you worried. Why is that?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, generally, I mean, like, you know, people always, you know, are very worried that technology is making us, you know, shallow or narcissistic or whatnot. And I've always been a little less convinced of that because if you look at basic surveys of the American personality type, it hasn't really changed much at all in decades and decades. And these concerns about becoming like shallower are as old as the hills. But there is something different, I think, with the reverse chronology thing insofar as this is the one thing that the technology does that's genuinely new, which is that it is constantly letting us know, hey, someone just said this, check it out, you know, stop what you're doing and go look at it. And that's very different from most other forms of media. The closest thing would be maybe like, you know, like kind of the way CNN started 20 years ago when they broadcasting 24 hours a day. And like, you know, it was a constant stream of here, this just breaking news. You know, but this is different because this is breaking kind of the breaking news of everyday life. Like, you know, your friend just said that, you know, or a celebrity you follow just said that. So it's like conversation. It's like, it's sort of like being stuck at a party where there's always something happening that you have to pay attention to, or someone saying something that they want you to respond to. And that is new. And that sort of worries me because I think you know, we humans are really attuned to, you know, the moment. In fact, it's very hard to get us out of the moment. It's our natural state is to live in the moment, you know, and that for good reasons. That, you know, survival skill, you know, over tens of thousands of years, pay attention to what's happening around you. But, you know, a lot of the way that we, when you have to manage any sort of a problem in your life, you know, whether that's in your life or in your work or whatnot, you have to sort of step back for a second and think about, you know, how you got in the situation, how to plan to get out of it, what to learn from the past. So anytime you want to deal with something that's complicated, it's better to sort of pull back from the moment a little bit. And I think this is the one thing that social media makes it very hard to do, is to pull back and consider what's going on in a more measured way.
Yeah, it's a perspective issue, it seems like. And I've been in this position, you know, even here at work, looking at Twitter to see what's going on. The bulk of my attention when I'm on Twitter is the thing that's there right now, the thing that's in this moment. And that may well not be the most important thing going on in the world, in my job, in my life.
Yeah, no, it's exactly right. I mean, sometimes I once thought, you know, in a way, one of the problems with social media is that it reminds me almost of like the 1960s concept of the happening, right? Where, you know, oh my God, you had to be there at Woodstock to sort of see what was going on. And if you missed that moment, oh man, you missed out on like this crazy thing that only the people who were there saw that. And there's this feeling I think people get from social media, reverse chronological social media, is that there's always a happening going on, you know? Like there's always some controversy or some funny thing that someone said or some witty thing that someone said, and everyone's responding to it. And it feels like this constant succession of happenings that you don't want to miss. And that, you know, it's very, you know, that can be a lot of fun, but you know, if it becomes the default setting for where you put your attention, now that's a problem because you're always reacting to something, you know, like, and you're always being reactive and being dragged around by circumstance instead of sort of trying to control your attention.
Talking to Clive Thompson about social media, he says the way it's structured, it leaves us stuck in the moment, and that has some bad outcomes potentially. We'll get into that. And Clive, in the piece we're talking about, you wrote about some media scholars of the past kind of tracing the development of more and more disposable forms of information. You carve something on a stone tablet, it's going to stick around for a while. You print it on a newspaper, it's relevant today, and then it's disposable. This has been accelerating, this news now that is gone tomorrow or in 10 seconds.
Yeah, that's right. I was very influenced by reading the communication scholar Harold Innes, who in the early 20th century, he got very concerned by the way that he saw modern media evolving. And for him, modern media was really just like the daily newspaper, right? I mean, you know, we think we've got troubles. You know, he was looking at the newspaper, and he was saying, you know, if you went back, you know, a thousand or, you know, or a couple thousand years, media was very slow moving because it was expensive and hard to make, right? So, you know, if you chiseled stuff on a cuneiform tablet, that stuff was going to be there for a long time. So, you know, information endured for a long time, and people thought about stuff for a long time. You know, things began to speed up when you had paper because suddenly you could generate a lot more documents. And so you began to see the explosion of everyday communications that really for him went into overdrive with the daily newspaper, which is where you see our modern logic of news emerging, which is the idea that every day there will be a new set of circumstances for you to read and think about. And it's actually going to be kind of hard to go back in time. I mean, think about it. Like when the newspaper emerged in the in the early to mid 19th century, if you read your daily paper and threw it away, it was pretty hard to go back and figure out what happened the day before, right? Like, that was the beginning of kind of the reverse chronologization, I guess, of society. And that really unsettled Innes. And he said, you know, this is trending in a bad direction, because newspapers, the inherent logic of a newspaper is to say that what happened yesterday is gone. What happened last week is totally gone. What happened last decade, oh my goodness, that's gone. And who cares what happened, you know, a century ago? He saw it as a systematic erasure of history. Now, he was obviously being a little harsh on it. A lot of great things came out of newspapers, right? You know, like they were crucibles for a certain type of liberal democracy. So there was good stuff that I think he was sort of ignoring. But he was right. He was right about the drift towards being, you know, very focused on that kind of, you know, hey, this is happening, drop everything and check it out. That really began with the newspapers, and has accelerated dramatically with social media.
So while our minds are in the moment, what are we losing? What is hurting here, because we're caught in the moment?
I think the main thing that's hurting is our ability to step back and connect the dots over time. Because if you are being constantly discouraged from thinking about not just what happened 10 years ago, not just what happened last year, but what happened like yesterday, it becomes harder as a society to sort of think about how we got in some of the pickles we got into, and thus how to plan for the future. I mean, if you think about it, every major social problem we've had has generally come from a combination of failing to heed the patterns of the past and failing to plan for the future, right? And you know, right now, if you were to think about what are some of the biggest social issues we have? Like some of the things like, you know, climate change, global warming. To take that one for one. Well, this is something that requires us to, you know, think carefully about what some plans that might go a few years, a few more years, a few decades out might be, and to talk about them soberly. And that is just a hard thing to do when you're getting dragged in 20 directions every day by the latest hot take on something that Trump said, or something that, you know, a celebrity said, or something even that your friends said, right? Planning, I think, is what goes by the wayside, you know, the more we get moored in the present.
Clive Thompson is with us. He writes about how technology affects everyday life. He says social media keeps us stuck in the present, in the moment, and that's a problem for our future. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been there on your Twitter feed, on your Facebook feed? Do you feel like social media has you focused on the present moment? Is it harder for us to think as individuals, as a society, about long-term trends, lessons from the past, lessons for the future? And how do you in your life take a step back and get some history, some context, some perspective? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation now with Clive Thompson, contributing writer at Wired and the New York Times Magazine, looking at how social media keeps us locked, he says, in the present moment, and that affects the way we think about the world's big issues. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about how your Facebook or Twitter feed is laid out? Always, almost always, the newest stuff right up at the top. Do you get sucked in? Do you like when you've gotten sucked in like that, to spend a lot of time? Do you feel like you're having a hard time thinking about the big picture? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to your calls now. Doug is on the line in Stevens Point. Doug, hi.
I got tons to say about it, but I'll try to keep it quick. I had Facebook and whatnot until probably about 4 years ago, and I deleted everything, and I've been free of it all, and it's been awesome. I used to get so caught up in all the political arguments and then trying to make my point and realizing that I'm just arguing back and forth for no reason, because it's not like anybody actually cared about my point. But I think that because it's so instantaneous, it causes us to use our emotional reactions to react to things instead of when we're able to give some time and thought about stuff, we wouldn't emotionally react. So because of that, it keeps our emotions wound up more often, more of the time, because of all these things going on that either upset us or whatever. And I didn't know if you had talked about that at all or not before. But
Doug, thanks for the call. We haven't. Clive, what do you think?
Yeah, I think he's really onto something there. I mean, the thing about social media is that it is it has essentially conversational dynamics, right? Like it's not like sitting down and responding to a letter someone wrote to you. It's not even like responding to an article someone wrote. It has a little bit of the sort of to and fro of conversation. And so the problem is, you know, conversation triggers, I think, a lot of those, you know, senses of great immediacy. Like, well, I've got to resolve this right now, right now, right now. I have to sort of talk about this right now. And that can sort of, you know, get exactly into the cycle this gentleman's talking about. And sometimes I thought, you know, I'm old enough to have remembered, you know, kind of flame wars and discussion boards and whatnot. So, you know, some of this stuff is very, very old. It's not that new. But there is an extent to which, you know, some of the old school discussion boards that I used to frequent back in the 90s, they had kind of a slower pace because there was no news feed telling you the instant someone posted something. Like you might have gone to a board and, you know, said something and said hello and then gone away and come back, you know, a day later, discover someone had said something. So there was kind of a slightly slower, almost like playing a game of chess pace to the conversation. And I sometimes think this, you know, is really something we ought to be aiming to look for more in our modern social media, something that actually intentionally slows down the pace so as to not get in those emotional loops that this gentleman is talking about.
Doug, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go next to Bill on the line in Greendale. Bill, hi.
Hi, great conversation. I think the previous caller stole mine in a way because I was going to say it's just a different take on the moment. Like you're saying, we're too much in the moment, and I take you saying it meaning I'm too much in that media moment. But I do think, for me and for a lot of us, social media, if we don't watch, it can take us away from our present experience, like looking up from the cell phone. I mean, maybe it's a generational thing with me, but I know I have something to share to a lot of the young folk who just, it's just so taking away from the moments that I think I and other people could have.
Bill, thanks for that call. And this is a complaint we hear a lot, a bit different than this piece, Clive, but it's an issue I think you've talked about elsewhere, the idea that by having our moments mediated by social media, we're not directly experiencing them enough.
Yeah, I mean, like, I definitely think it's true that, like, if it's that type of thing where, like, you know, you go through, like, the art gallery looking at everything through your phone and not actually with your eyes, you know, and I think that, I mean, I've done that, right? You know, I mean, I know what that feels like. I think that's true. I definitely think that it is, it's good to not always be experiencing life thinking, like, how am I going to tweet or Facebook about this? Although, I mean, like, you know, the flip side of it is, there is an extent, the reason why we like these tools, the reason why we like them, partly because these companies have spent a huge amount of time trying to get us addicted with these casino-like, you know, mechanisms of reverse cron. But there's also legitimate things we find useful and delightful. Like when I say that they are a conversational form of media, I sort of mean that as a compliment, that like there are types of conversations that we can have that you could never really have before because you weren't able to communicate over a long distance or to communicate over a long period of time, like to have a threaded conversation that goes on for days. This is a really powerful, interesting thing. So the way I always look at this is I'm like, these are all really design challenges. You know, you could easily redesign each of these services to ease back on the addictiveness of the here and now and to encourage people to be a little more deliberate. They're not doing it because there's a lot of money to be made in just keeping people constantly glued to their screens. But there are lots of other ways you could design these spaces. And that's sort of, that is really where I would love to see society move towards. It's hard to figure out how to get there because the companies are making a lot of money as they are right now. And I don't think they have any incentive to change, if you know what I mean.
Thanks, Bill, for that call. We're talking to Clive Thompson about social media. He says it's keeping our attention stuck in the moment. We're having a hard time, he thinks. He worries putting things in context. And, Clive, I want to get a little more into your ideas, your hopes for something to make it work better. You wrote about let's see if I had this right. When that instant thing comes up, that latest piece of news, why not something that scours out there and finds a 10-year-old article that's relevant, or a 100-year-old academic thing, or some kind of historical precedent?
Yeah, sure. I mean, look, we have this is my point about, in a weird way, about designing these spaces. Like, there's nothing inevitable about the way that Twitter or Facebook are designed. They intentionally said, we think we can get people to click on more stuff if we do this reverse cron. And, you know, that's great for their business model, but it's not necessarily good for society. So you start to think, well, let's have some fun with this. Let's think, how would you design a social network that actually encouraged us to think not just about this moment, but about other relevant moments in the past? Well, you know, yeah, one thing you could do is you could say, well, you know, what if when you posted something, it found other interesting comments, like the most interesting comments that have been said on that subject from previous weeks, years, months, even of your own? What if it tried to surface really interesting, you know, articles, you know, from the distant past and tried to connect them to the trajectory of your current thinking? You know, we have all these computers, we have these algorithms that we can design to do all sorts of different things, that do very exciting and, I think, intellectually daring things. And so I was trying to encourage readers to sort of think a bit about themselves and imagine or envision what a different and better social media experience might be like.
Let's go back to our callers. We've got Angela with us in La Crosse. Angela, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call.
What do you think?
Well, basically, just kind of adding to what some other listeners have said, social media used very intentionally is one of the greatest unifiers of all, that we can unify with people not only in our surrounding community but around the world. But it's also one of the biggest dividers, because of people at the same table can be in completely separate places and never really aware of one another. So I really think that it can definitely take away from the present moment, but it also can create historical movements, because we can join together instantaneously with people that we've never met. So it's both.
Angela, thanks a lot for the call. And Clive, as we wrap up, kind of following on what Angela said, how can we, assuming that social media companies aren't going to fix this all tomorrow, how can we as users engage with it in a more positive way, just in our last minute and a half or so?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I that's a great question. The caller is exactly right. There are amazing things that come out of a more intelligent and mindful use of social media. I think a few things you can do are, one is pay a little more attention to how long you're using it for, right? You regard it as a place to go to read and find out what's going on, have conversations, but not just to stew in it all day long. I sometimes set a little timer for myself. Like, I'm going to do like 20 minutes of Twitter here, but then I'm going to go back and do other stuff. And it makes me be a little more judicious with it, makes me a little more thoughtful. So I think just paying attention to how much time you're there and why you're there is the first step to sort of reclaiming a little bit of your attention and using these spaces for the remarkable powers they have.
And then we can maybe take that time and use it for the bigger picture?
Absolutely. And, you know, frankly, while you're at it, hey, you know, write a letter. Right? You know, whenever Twitter or Facebook says, how are we doing? Write them a note and say, guys, this reverse cron thing, this constant hankering at us to look at the moment, let's think of a better way. You know, I think if enough people started really pushing at them, they might start to take attention to that.
Clive, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I had fun. Take care.
That's Clive Thompson. He's the author of the book Smarter Than You Think, How Technology is Changing Our Minds for the Better. He's talking to us today about a way that technology could be changing our minds for a bit worse. He says social media keeps us stuck in the present moment, and that can hurt our ability to engage with complex problems as individuals and as a society. Still time for you to share your thoughts on this moment. You can do that over at the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Have you changed the way you use social media or cut out social media for some of the reasons our guest has been talking about? Let us know. Well, I guess you can't do that at the Ideas Network Facebook page. A couple of weeks back, we talked to Jennifer Barney, a baker in Stoddard. She's been a contestant on the Food Network's Holiday Baking Championship. And as revealed last night on the show, Wisconsin has a winner. Jennifer won it all with a Christmas-themed gingerbread eggnog cake. She had to make it on the theme of six geese a-layin' from the 12 Days of Christmas. Plus, there was an extra bonus challenge making a dozen petit-fours shaped like holiday presents, still on that same time limit, though. She outlasted eight other bakers over the run of the show to win the $50,000 prize. As reported in the La Crosse Tribune, she hopes to open a bakery in La Crosse. She currently has an industrial kitchen, I guess, at home. Now, the show taped back in the summer before anybody was thinking about Christmas cookies and cakes, but she couldn't tell anyone that she was the winner until the show aired yesterday. I guess her husband was in on it, but that was it. She gathered friends and family at a theater in Eau Claire to watch the final episode. So congratulations to Jennifer Barney on winning this holiday baking championship. We'll have to get some samples down here at the Central Time headquarters. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.